This is a continuation of the Easter series of meditations on Vipralamba Seva. The love of God manifests in different categories as justice, as mercy, and grace. Justice means that everyone inevitably, eventually, receives their due reward for their pious and impious activities. Mercy means that we are shielded from some suffering that we deserve. And grace means an unreserved, indiscriminate flow of unrestricted goodness that we cannot possibly deserve. The deity Gopal, who is, rediscovered by Madhavendra Puri, had a yearning to display the depth of Madhavendra Puri's love. Now, this is related to Vipralamba Seva. So, Madhavendra Puri, who was a desire tree from Goloka Vrindavan, specifically at Nidivan, who offered shelter to Radha and Krishna in their pastimes and therefore observed the nature of Krishna's love firsthand, whereby he became the first acharya in the line of Madhva to introduce Madhurya Ras. And as Srila Prabhupada tells it, up until the time of Lakshmipati Tirtha, Madhavendra Puri's guru, the worship in the Madhva Sampradaya was so highly ritualistic that there was hardly a trace of pure love. That was introduced in full-fledged form by Madhavendra Puri. And what that has to do with the most exalted love found in Vipralamba Seva is that famous verse, which is like the door opening to the treasury of ecstatic love, which is like the Kastuba jewel, shedding tremendous illumination in the form of the most mellow poetry. That verse is like the Malaya sandalwood that Madhavendra Puri carried thousands of kilometers for the pleasure of Gopal to be ultimately accepted by Gopinath. And that verse is like the benediction moon illuminating the world with the luster of the love of Vrindavan. The verse, which no fourth person can understand. Who were the three?
Oh, Mary, Magdalena.
No, we're still in Krishna Lila now, before the parallel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anyway, there's only three persons who can understand the purport of this verse. That is, Srimati Radharani, who initially spoke the verse, Madhavendra Puri, who by her grace was able to repeat the verse with total realization, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who couldn't stop chanting that verse at the conclusion of his narration of the story of Madhavendra Puri during the night they spent at Sakshi Gopal's temple, awaiting the kheer to be distributed after Artik. So, the verse, Aidina Dayadanatahe, O my Lord, most merciful Master, O Master of Mathura, when shall I see you again? On account of not seeing you, my delirious heart has become unsteady. O most beloved one, what shall I do now? That verse was uttered by Srimati Radharani, articulating the feelings of separation of all the Brijabasis after Krishna had left for Mathura. And they were, and you know, the marks of the chariot wheels were still fresh on the dirt road, keeping the topic very alive. And they were, Nanda Maharaj was so innocent that he believed Akura when he said that, you know, Krishna would be back soon. And how could Mother Yashoda let him go? Why didn't she just climb on the chariot? Which means that all we gopis would follow. And then after Krishna left, Vrindadevi had no incentive to beautify the forest or prepare flower petal beds or inspire the different foliage to bloom out of season. And then Srimati Radharani, holding a letter from Krishna in her tender hands, it was a letter written on flower petals, which turned to dust because of the fire of separation blazing in her hearts and just slipped through her fingers. And the letter said, it was a letter from Krishna saying that he would be back soon. And whatever, and foremost of Krishna's virtues is truthfulness. So if he said he will be back soon, he has to mean it. But then he's got a reputation of leaving a trail of disappointment wherever he goes. So who could take those words literally? So Srimati Radharani was thinking that Krishna will come back when he hears that I've died. But I can't die because that'll make him unhappy. So I have to continue to live in this anguish of separation. So, as she fell to her knees on the side of the road, gazing in the direction of Mathura and seeing Krishna in a mystic vision, she articulated the most selfless and complete love of the Brijabasis in that verse. Aidina Dayadanatahe. And the depth and purity articulated in those words, it was so profound that only those three personalities can understand, meaning Srimati Radharani, Madhavendra Puri, and Lord Chaitanya. So the question naturally arises, why did Krishna subject the Brijabasis to such anguish? Why did he subject himself to the endless pain of separation from the Brijabasis? And the external reason he gave was to protect the Brijabasis from the persecution of his own enemies, who would continue to attack Vrindavan, jeopardizing the welfare of all the Brijabasis. So Krishna moved to Mathura to have the reinforcements of the Jadus and the fortifications of Mathura city. Which is all external, because there was a greater enemy that still stalked Vrindavan in Krishna's presence, and that greater enemy was Krishna's presence. And Krishna had experienced that the Brijabasis suffer more in his presence than in his absence. Because in his presence they're always so fearful that he's going to leave. Even if he doesn't leave Vrindavan, he divides up his day between mornings and early evening with Nanda and Yashoda, later morning and afternoon with the Gopas, noon at midnight with the gopis. So he has to divide up his time between his different devotees. And they all suffer in his absence when he's with the others. and they suffer more in his presence due to the fear of imminent separation, knowing that he has a pattern of leaving his devotees with the hope of his return, that he will return. And how this applies to sadhakas is that Krishna, in his dealings with the Brijabasis, facilitated and demonstrated that in his absence they maintain their lives by the combined strength of chanting his holy names and making eternal preparations in expectation that today is the day he will return. And in union with Krishna, the Brijabasis, as the exemplar of all devotees, in Krishna's presence they pour out their hearts to him. And in his absence, they take him within their hearts, and the whole external world becomes irrelevant as the internal dynamic is activated by the highest ecstasy of Vipralamba Seva. And that is the essence of the festival of Easter. Jesus had prepared his disciples that he would be leaving them, and he even told them it is better that he leave, because then the Spirit of Truth would lead them into deeper communion and intimacy with him, which was totally mysterious to his apostles. The first indication of hope after that horrific event of the crucifixion was the two apostles who were returning to their previous houses, which had ceased to become home, but it's just the only place they had left to go. And we discussed that the other day, which highlights the importance of extending an invitation to the Lord. Because whatever exalted or saintly personalities we may encounter, it does not create a lasting or transformative relationship unless we extend an invitation. Come to my home. Because there's things in our home that we hide even from ourselves. And do we really want somebody to become aware of our deepest feelings, which is to love and be loved, which requires that we know and are known. So when the Cleopas and his unnamed friend invite Jesus into their home, not knowing that it was him yet, because this is after the crucifixion, he's just a stranger who appeared to them on the road and met them right where they were at and spoke of things they'd heard so many times before. But they were hearing it in an entirely different way. And the difference was in the narrator. Jesus, from the time of Genesis to Moses to the Psalms to the present, was reciting scriptures in which there were prophecies regarding himself. So when they reached their home and extended an invitation, and he raised the bread, which is the way they make their offering. They take the bread and raise it and break it and then distribute it. That's comparable to our offering bhoga to become prasad, and demonstrates that the Lord does not want to continue being merely our companion on the path, or the one who goes before, who can perform any miracle at any time. But as our hearts are ever restless until we repose them in Krishna, he is also restless until we invite him into our own hearts in a communion so deep and transcendent that physical senses cannot perceive or understand. So, at that instant, when they recognized Jesus, he disappeared. And then he ran back to Jerusalem, completely inspired and hopeful and eager to tell the other apostles that he's still alive. When they found out that the other apostles had been informed by Mary Magdalene, who was the first to go alone and discover the empty tomb and all the symbolism that that held. And in the tomb, she found two angels who asked her, "Why are you looking for the living amongst the dead? Didn't he say he would rise on the third day?" And she ran to tell the disciples, but in the garden she saw an effulgent personality, and she asked him, "Have you seen Jesus?" And when he responded, "Mary," and she recognized his voice, and she tried to hold him, he said, "You cannot hold me now because I have not yet returned to my Father." And what he's saying here is he's beginning a new level and depth of relationship with his apostles, which transcends the mortal and the physical. Therefore, he would not allow her to touch him as she had done before, because he was introducing her into a new depth and realm of relationship, leading into deeper intimacy. And That is an opportunity. Extending that invitation for the Lord to come to us in a place where darkness cannot reach and death cannot sever, and it is a realm where our physical senses would be blinded by the light in which Sri Isha Upanishad prays, Lord, please remove that blinding effulgence so that I can see your smiling face on the other side of it. And the topic where we kind of ended last week's discussion on Easter was that verse which articulates the anguish of separation. My Lord, why have you forsaken me? It's one of the last words that Jesus uttered before he breathed his last. What is the significance of that verse? You can appreciate from different angles. Because in the homily within the temple at that time, because in Solomon's temple, in Herod's, which replaced it, the homily sung at different times of the day, just like we have our ragas for the two articulate the mood and the feelings of the Astakalya Lila, therefore the ragas changed throughout the eight periods of the day, because the feelings evoked by the different pastimes change. So at that time, this is early afternoon, when darkness blocked the sun, and the shroud in the temple, which was 30 feet high, it shred from top to bottom, which means that no man could have done it. The Lord himself shred that shroud which blocks the vision of the Lord from the sinful and made him accessible to everyone except the priest who came running out of the temple frantically screaming that the God has left the temple. My God, why have you forsaken me? This is the words of David. And as the psalms were sung within the temple, there were different melodies, which is a reflection of the ragas, which complement the sentiments of the words. And the hymn at this time of day was sung in the melody of the deer at dawn. So it's the words of David echoed in the Psalms, sung in the temple, simultaneous to Jesus uttering those same words from the cross. And it is David, in his most extreme anguish of suffering apparent rejection from friends, family, and God, in that verse, my God, why have you forsaken me? Proclaims his faith that the Lord, through his providence, will lead him out of this anguish of heart and into a deeper joy concealed within it. And this is the perfection of the science of mourning from the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Mourning means acknowledging our own co-responsibility in the evil that surrounds and pervades us in this world. And until we acknowledge our own part and grieve and mourn the loss, the guilt, the fear, the unanswered questions, battling for answers in our hearts, until we mourn our losses, they cannot be lifted by Guru into a larger story, a great mystery, embracing all generations, which will qualify us to be acknowledged as blessed. We are invited into a larger experience, granting new hope and courage, in which every individual is offered a unique role in the Lord's unending story of redemption and forgiveness, which is the message that Jesus exhorted his apostles to go out and preach. So, as long as our hearts are afflicted with worldliness, we must remain deprived of any substantial relish or taste for the holy name, pastimes, and teachings of the Lord, which will appear as insipid tales, which means tasteless, lifeless, dull. Until and unless we embrace the teachings of Lord Chaitanya in the third verse of his Shikshastakam. Chinarapi sinichena tororapi sahishnana. In order to properly relish the holy name, pastimes, and teachings of the Lord, we must become as tolerant as the grass, who is continuously trampled but never protests, as tolerant as the tree, that even when he's being abused so seriously, cut down and chopped up, he never ceases to extend every part of himself for the welfare of others. And success is twofold: our constant endeavor and our firm faith in the assured marvelous results of chanting the holy name. But the soul afflicted with worldliness is like the body diseased with jaundice, making the taste of sugar appear to be bitter. And it is only when we regain our sense of the taste of sweetness in the sugar that we can understand that the disease is healing, as we discover or rediscover our taste for the sweetness of Krishna's holy name, pastimes, and teachings. And if we do not develop this quality of forbearance, we will find, we'll find out anyway, that the path back to Godhead is not strewn with soft rose petals, but is beset with thorns and sharp stones. And we will find that surrounding that spring of eternal joy are merciless persecutions. And our adversaries will inflict piercing wounds and words. And our friends will deride us. And even our own minds will wonder, why did we take to this path? And if we succumb to fear and disappointment that yield to doubt and despair, we will be hurled back down into the utter vortex of anguish and utter disappointment, to such an extent that we may doubt Krishna's love or accuse him mentally of being cruel or partial, and we may fault ourselves for adopting such a noble path. And it is patience and perseverance that will overcome the mountains of obstacles on that path, as stated by Kaviraj Goswami, that forgetting Lord Chaitanya, everything becomes difficult. Remembering him, everything becomes possible. And by the grace of Lord Gauranga, even a dumb man can recite eloquent poetry. A blind man can see the luster of the stars shining in the sky, and even a lame man can cross over mountains of obstacles. And however disappointing, they can be interpreted as Krishna's grace arranged out of his love to help us develop a spirit of contrition, which means, what does contrition mean? What's the definition? Remorse for our own misdeeds and our own part in the evils which pervade and surround us. And contrition can only arise from a heart which is contrite, which means that we let go of any sense of retaliation, as Haridas Thakur demonstrated and personified. It is not by revenge that hatred is killed, but by love alone is envy stilled. And Haridas Thakur, like Jesus, prayed that his tormentors be forgiven. And may these words echo within our hearts as we aspire to develop taste for the Holy Name. Any questions, comments?
Thank you very much, Maharaj. I have a couple. You were talking on the end about being tolerant, humble, forbearing. Where to be able to gain real taste for the Holy Name?
In pastimes and teachings of the Lord.
Right. Where is that? My question is about that border, because sometimes, you know, we can tolerate things which we maybe should not tolerate, what we call these days.
You can call that false toleration.
Or what's the word? Abuse or things like that. So would you elaborate? Where the tolerance is not...
Yeah, there's borders where anything trespasses from what's healthy to what's unhealthy. You can tolerate sufferings that come of their own accord as reactions to our previous karmas, and by tolerating them rather than reacting, we put an end to that chapter of our karma rather than perpetuate it. But that has to be adjusted when it comes to abuse. Humility is not an invitation to abuse. And if it is misused as such, then we have to choose another means of expressing it.
Or even mistreating.
Or as you were just reading, humility is synonymous with truth. Truth, what about your own position in relation to the Lord and creation? So gratitude in all things does not mean gratitude for all things, such as primarily abuse. We should not be grateful for abuse. We should be grateful in abuse. And we should never tolerate in the same way if that is taken as an invitation for abuse, which it can be interpreted as such, in which case you have to change your expression of humility from what Narada told the serpent, his disciple, the serpent, who came to him one day and said, "My dear Gurudev Narada, you told me to be humble and tolerant like a tree, but people are just trampling me and abusing me now." And what did Narada say to his disciple?
"What?
I didn't say you couldn't raise your hoods and show your fangs. Just don't bite."
Yeah, that's because
they're both humility. To be, you know, willing to be trampled, but if it becomes an invitation for abuse, then you raise your hoods and show your fangs.
Because abuse is kind of maybe clear, but let's talk about more gray area when it's harder to distinguish. Shall I tolerate or shall I not?
The gray area is taking advantage of.
What do you mean?
That's the borderline region between appreciating humility and abusing it. In between is taking advantage of it. Doormat, a common question. Does humility mean that I become a doormat? No, it doesn't.
You know, at the same time, I'm hearing that a Vaishnava does not really argue or defeat him or herself. So when there is some kind of misunderstanding or miscommunication, and we may be accused of things which we haven't done, or so then.
Then again, humility is synonymous with truth. If you're falsely accused, you have a duty to both truth and humility. If you're falsely accused, you have every right to express the truth, but you have to do it in a detached way. Because if you're attached, it can be easily taken as a confession of guilt. If you express the truth in an impartial, detached way, you have fulfilled your obligation to truth. Whether the other person accepts or not, or continues to accuse you, is where you express the other face of truth, which is humility. It doesn't mean you can't express the truth. It doesn't mean you can't defend yourself, but you have to do it in an impartial, detached way, meaning you're not taking it personally.
We have the example of Advaita Acharya and the one who put the paraphernalia for worshipping.
Oh, Srivas Thakur and Gopal.
Srivas Thakur, yes.
Gopal Tapala, yes.
So, And he didn't do anything. See, I mean, so there isn't like, seems like there are levels of, it's not one way which fits all, right? He didn't do anything. But then you say that we have the right to truth, and we could explain.
Well, what was his response when he came out on this veranda and saw the blood and wine and all the offerings for Durga? What did he do?
He admit, he said, yes, I'm doing it. That's what he said.
He invited everybody to come see. Look, I'm guilty of worshipping Durga, which he wasn't.
Right, but he said he did the other, opposite to what you are saying. Almost, or something like that.
First of all, nobody believed him.
Right.
Secondly, the Lord corrected the situation. And Gopal was afflicted with leprosy. But what does that mean? Srivast Thakur didn't have to defend himself because the Lord himself made it very clear who was at guilt and how he had to suffer the consequences. Gopal Tepala.
So in our situations, the key is that we can explain, we have the right to truth. But the key is the detachment and what did you say?
Humility. Well, detachment and humility, they're all interrelated. Truth and humility are synonymous. So if somebody falsely accuses you, you actually have a duty to state the truth. It's not within your control if the person's going to accept, and you have to adjust your presentation to how the person responds or reacts. Because you don't want to aggravate the situation.
So how do you understand that statement that a devotee does not defend himself? That to me would... maybe it wouldn't be defending statement.
No, it's not defending. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending are the qualities of the conditioned soul. You know, you could call it defense.
But it's more clarification and explanation.
Truth. It's truth.
Yes.
We're duty-bound to truth. But if that's not accepted, and the abuse or whatever continues, your equal obligation is to humility. Mm-hmm. Which means that, you know, nothing can come upon you that is not either a reaction coming from your previous karma or an arrangement made by the Lord to demonstrate the virtues and glories of his devotee, in which case the Lord will rectify any misdeeds as he did with Gopal Tapala. Srivast Thakur didn't have to defend himself because nobody believed it. And he didn't have to rectify the situation because he knew the Lord would. And he did. And it made it very clear to everyone without any defense that who was at guilt, who was responsible.
So another...
Who was the guilty party became very evident.
So then we can also exercise our trust that Krishna, if we do what we can do with the detachment and humility, then we can just trust Krishna that he's going to do the rest.
Yes.
Whatever is needed.
Now, look at that statement, exercise your trust. Trust has to be exercised for it to grow, like anything. Like any muscle in your body, it won't grow without exercising, which means you have to apply it, even a little bit beyond your comfort zone, knowing that you'll see the reciprocation from Krishna, if it's not artificial. Pushing your comfort zone a little bit is not pretentious or artificial. It's actually very natural and healthy. But if you just stay completely within your comfort zone, then you never grow in trust and faith and love. If you exercise those boundaries a little bit, they grow. The virtues grow and develop in a healthy way. Okay, so why did the smartas, the smartas in Lord Gauranga's time, or Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's time, were, vehement enemies of the truth, which is why they conspired to kill Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And how, what was the most shameful extreme to which those smartas of Nadia or Pharisees of Judea went? The Pharisees went to the governor, Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, pleaded their case. And what were the three charges against Jesus? Blasphemy. He's saying he's the Son of God, which is of no concern to the Romans. Blasphemy number two, he said he could destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, which was of no concern to the Romans. Third charge, he proclaims himself to be the king of the Jews. Well, Herod was the king of the Jews. That was definitely a Roman concern. And they threatened to report the case back to Caesar if Herod didn't take initiative. Because Herod could see this is a total setup. Three, what do you call the kind of trial that's just a total farce? Three sham trials. Caiaphas, Herod, Pontius Pilate. And the most objective, honest one was the Roman governor, who was a barbarian. But he could see this is a total pretentious trial. But they threatened, if you don't take action, we'll report you to Caesar. They told the Tanakhazi, who didn't really want to retaliate against the Sankirtan movement, if you don't, we will report you to the Nawab Hussein Shah, who was Jarasandha, the father-in-law of Kamsa, who is now Tanakhazi.
So what was... the herald, what the herald had and the Qazi and the other didn't, the others, they had something, they were more envious or something which made them be so envious or, what I'm saying?
Well, envy is the root of all evil. But the Pharisees and the smartas, they're addicted to the rules and regulations, and they think that that's your path back to Godhead, is by perfectly following the rules and regulations, which nobody can do perfectly. And they're putting rules and regulations above grace, whereas they really need to go together. You can't just say it's all... You say, I believe in Jesus, and you are saved. Well, it's not just a matter of saying you believe. You have to demonstrate it. Otherwise, it's sterile. It's lifeless. It's and the demonstration is based on grace. Or the success is based on grace, but the expression is partly through the rules and regulations. There again, your own endeavor and Krishna's grace. Your own endeavor is following the rules and regulations, making the endeavor. But knowing that alone is doesn't do it. That attracts, you could say it attracts the grace, but more than that, it opens your heart to the grace. Just like the fasting. The fasting opens a space in your heart for something spiritual, because it's not just so full of the material. And it's interesting that, you know, at the time of the crucifixion, all the apostles ran and hid. Because, you know, the Roman occupational, barbaric presence was so intimidating, because they would crucify even, you know, the wife or the child of a criminal if they showed any sympathy. And that's largely related to the fact that crucifixion was usually reserved for rebels, those who were seen as rebels. And Jesus was, you know, leading a revolution. So, out of fear, the apostles all ran and hid, with the exception of who?
John
and Mary and Mary and Mary. The three Marys. And Mary Magdalene, you know, had been just the most faithful and supportive from day one. And she's also the most highly... She's a mysterious figure. And, you know, the target of so much, you know, heresy and abuse. And even though... You know, we don't know if she was unmarried or if she was a widow. She definitely had no husband. And in that culture, a wife can't possess anything. You know, a father or a husband may provide for her, but she can't own anything in that society. She was funding the missionary activities of Jesus more than anyone. She demonstrated such a quality of loyalty. And then, so, you know, she wouldn't leave his side at great jeopardy to her own self, along with Mary and Mary and John, the three Marys and John. but really, you know, they say that, you know, Peter is the rock upon which the church was built. But really, Mary is the source of the revelation at Easter, which is the foundation for Christian belief in redemption. And that great hope we all have for the ultimate victory of life over death, which is also an understatement. Because what is it that we find that this blessed Mother Earth, and by the way, all the Earth goddesses coalesced into Mary. We don't hear worship of the Earth goddess after Mary, Mother Mary. Mother Earth, she adorns herself in various attire, from springtime flowers of 10,000 varieties to autumn foliage and winter crystals and summer bounty, to infuse her residence with an endless urge of celebration, as expressed through the Jiva's endless devotional songs in dances, in rituals, in poetry, in stories, which proclaim more than the hope of ultimate victory of life over death, the belief held in the archetypal world of the collective unconscious, in a world beyond the reach of birth and death. And that is really what we are celebrating in our great hope, which is sustaining and nourishing our existence.
I have another one. You said there are things in our home we hide even from ourselves, and then something along that Krishna, we cannot hide things from Krishna.
It's related to invitation. The Eucharist story is based on invitation. When the three reached the house of Cleopas and the two went in and the third kept going, who's the third? It's Jesus. After the crucifixion, he appeared in Vipralambaseva to his apostles. He kept going. He just assumed he was going to go in the house with them, but he kept going. And they called to him, come, join us. The day's almost over. Nighttime is coming. Join us for dinner. So he came in. But how many times do we experience an encounter with the Lord or his representative or his servant? We don't extend an invitation, hospitality. For a divine encounter or a potentially divine encounter to become transformative in the form of an eternal relationship, it requires an invitation. And why don't we want to do that? Because there's things in our home that we don't even want to see ourselves. But to become that vulnerable to someone else who sees everything when we invite him into our hearts, that can be intimidating. And therefore, we may miss the opportunity. But back to Augustine. Our hearts are always restless until they're reposed in Krishna. But if we examine the torturous story of our own salvation, we find that Krishna's heart is always restless until it receives an invitation from his parts and parcels to enter their hearts and homes. And what does Kaviraj Goswami say? The Lord resides in the hearts and homes of his devotees. It may be seen, may be unseen, but the truth is consistent. But it requires an invitation, which is another way of saying participation.
So is our chanting, our japa, the main invitation form of?
Yes. That's the main form, but it's facilitated and complemented by prayer. And offering our bhoga is the Vaishnav parallel to the Eucharist. And we're not only feeding the deity, but he's becoming our food and our drink and our very life breath in the form of the Holy Name. So it's reciprocal.
Yeah.
And experiencing and tasting the sweetness of that reciprocation is the source of our ongoing commitment and taste. But that requires Trinadapi Sinichena Doradapi Sahishnana Amanida Amanadena Kirtaniya Siddhari, as personified in Srila Madhavendra Puri.